Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Father, for this opportunity. As you know, this is something that I love speaking about. It's a welcome the opportunity to do this. And it's rare that you have a chance to speak to an audience where you know almost every single person here. It's just wonderful. And so it's so good to see you again. Really good to see you. So anyway, we know each other because I previously worked in the office at the parish. Prior to that, you know, there's a long time prior to that. But I have a doctorate in Russian literature from the University of Wisconsin, and I had a very short tenure as a university professor, and other than that, did a lot of administrative work, enjoyed that a whole lot more than teaching, I have a 40-year-old son living in New York City, and it's very possible we'll be able to send this to him. Hey, Mom. Okay, that's probably enough about me. Let's talk about more interesting things. I told Mother Daniel that there are two topics that I wanted to address with you tonight. The importance of Alexander Solzhenitsyn and the early onset of the persecution of the church under the Bolshevik regime. I hope I'll be able to marry these two into one cohesive presentation rather than two separate blocks of interesting but unrelated information, but I'll let you be the judge of that at the end. So both of these topics, however, have something important to tell us today about what concerns us most, how to live in these difficult times. So I know that you've been reading Dreher's book, Not to Live, or Live Not by Lies, and since Dreher takes his title from Solzhenitsyn, whom he recognizes as a great hero of the 20th century, it makes sense to spend some time introducing him in the event that you are not familiar with his work. And I find that most Americans are not. Forgive me if I'm being presumptuous here, his life and work are so monumental that it's hard to know where to begin. But I should also point out that Dreher's interviews with survivors of the communist epoch are not with Russians, but with Czechs, Slovaks, Hungarians, and Poles. And their experience was different from that of the Russians in at least this respect. As neighbors of Russia, they knew what was happening on the other side of the sealed border. And they had time to prepare, 30 years. And as you learned from Dreher, they did prepare. Their experience was also of a much shorter duration, only 45 years, roughly two generations. Russians endured 74 years, which would be at least three generations, and that additional generation was costly in terms of the loss of faith in Russian families. In the third and fourth chapters of Dreher's book, which I understand will be the subject of your discussion this evening, he lays out the ideology that threatens us today. Social justice wedded to progressivism, and the heightened means of implementing that ideology, technological data harvesting, and our naive choices in favor of technological conveniences. In the following chapters, he will take up the question of how to live in truth. And I hope my remarks this evening about Solzhenitsyn's witness to the truth and the persecution of the church will add to those discussions as you go forward in his book. Solzhenitsyn's literary output vies with that of Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. In addition to short stories, novellas, and plays, he left us two monumental works, The Gulag Archipelago, a literary investigation in three volumes, and The Red Wheel, a historical novel in eight volumes. As complex as each of these works is, tonight we can consider each as the exposition of a lie. So some historical context might be helpful. Stalin died March 5, 1953. 3 years later, Nikita Khrushchev denounced the great leader and his cult of personality in a secret session of the 20th Congress of the Communist Party. His speech sent shockwaves through the assembly and reverberated throughout the country, indeed throughout the world. It inaugurated the so-called Khrushchev Fall from the mid-50s to mid-60s, when repression and censorship were relaxed and millions of political prisoners were released from the Gulag camps. But in acknowledging Stalin's crimes against the people, Khrushchev also told a huge lie about the history of the 20th century in his country, a lie that has persisted to our own day, namely that Stalin was the culprit for all that had gone wrong. If it hadn't been for Stalin, things would have worked out quite well. Well, you've probably heard this. Oh yes, Stalin was an unforgivable tyrant, but not the system. To illustrate how the long life of this lie, I refer you to a recent piece in none other than the Washington Post. This past November, Irina Antonova, an internationally recognized art curator, died in Moscow at the age of 98, having lived through the entire 74 years of the communist epoch and then 24 years after its fall. She was eulogized in the Washington Post, and it was no surprise to me that the writer dug up a quote from this public figure 10 years ago. And here is what she said. "Perhaps I'm going to disappoint you now, but I haven't lost faith in socialism to this day. It's obvious that Stalin was a tyrant. We chose the wrong path to socialism in the Soviet Union, but that doesn't mean that the idea is worthless." Tell that to the families of those who have died in the name of socialism in the Soviet Union. Now, just why would a writer in the Washington Post last night want to bear witness to the rightness of the socialist path? Well, you can talk about that amongst yourselves. So anyway, as Khrushchev was giving a speech in 1956, Alexander Solzhenitsyn was living in exile in Kazakhstan after having finished an 8-year term in the Gulag. During the aforementioned thaw, the standards of literary censorship were slightly relaxed, and the editors of a prominent literary journal, making a very serious misjudgment on their part, allowed the publication of a novella by the newly released camp inmate, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. It is hard to describe the effect. That's just how it was. That's how it was. My uncle Dima was arrested, seized, and taken away when he was just standing at a bus stop. From all over the country came letters to the author, telling him of how his story resonated with theirs. And those letters, at least 227 of them, became a treasure that Solzhenitsyn guarded with his life. And they are the substance of the great three-volume work of literary investigation that he called the Gulag Archipelago. It is not a work of fiction. He termed it a literary investigation for lack of any other suitable designation. And the story of its composition and publication is beyond what we can discuss tonight. But let me say just one thing, that with millions of copies sold, he never took a dime for the publication. He always insisted that the work be made available in the very least expensive formats, the lowest prices, so that it might be widely read all over the world. I remember the day that my dad called me and said, "We just have a copy." And it's the copy we still have in my family. Yes, it was an event to have that. But anyway, that meant all the proceeds from the sales of his book went to the aid of political prisoners, and that remains true today. The opening chapters of Gulag Archipelago defiantly condemn the lie that the problems began with the psychopathic tyrant, Stalin, No, Solzhenitsyn says, no. The problems go right to the source, right to the very beginning of 1917. So to support Solzhenitsyn's claim, now let's look at how things were playing out for the church in the first years of the Bolshevik regime, which began with the October Revolution on November 7th, 1917. So Marx held that religion was nothing more than a structure built on a material base. So Lenin therefore argued that one can put an end to the church only by depriving it of its property. So day one of the new regime, that all-important day, November 8th, 1917, the decree of Lenin deprived the church of the right to avoid it. December 24th, all institutions of learning were placed under the People's Commissariat for Education. All academies, seminaries, parochial school, vocational training, college. February 2nd, 1918, the church was deprived of all property and the right to acquire property, so that if you wish to have a liturgical service, you could rent the church to use it. But those rental documents could not be executed by the clergy who had been reduced to the status of non-person. Okay, so lay people be appointed to execute such rental documents. The teaching of religious doctrine to children under the age of 18 was forbidden in schools and in homes. And now this is less than 3 months after the beginning of the Bolshevik regime. Things happened fast. They did not have the time to prepare for the Czechs and the Poles and the Hungarians had. This came like a flood. And the civil war that began immediately after the revolution and lasted until 1922 led to widespread economic disruption and famine, temporarily slowing down the pace of the struggle against the church, until the crisis became a golden opportunity. Oh yes, golden, yes. Seize the gold from all the churches to save the starving millions along the Volga. Those hypocritical Christians in there with all of the Orthodox Church at first was willing to give them items not used for the sacred liturgy, for example, the gold prints and the icons, but that wasn't enough. The government wanted all the chalices, the patterns, everything. The Catholics tried to say that they couldn't give anything without the Pope's permission, but that didn't work. For both churches, however, the seizure of valuables became the hot issue that led to show trials of the highest clergy. First, the Orthodox clergy, and then following that, the Czepiak trial. The Budkiewicz Czepiak trial in March, which began in March 1923, and was timed in such a way so that the sentences would be handed out on Easter Eve. Two death sentences, one for the bishop and one for the monsignors. I guess you could call them like the dean of the archdiocese. But anyway, Bishop Chinnak's death sentence was commuted to a 10-year prison term, but Monsignor Budkiewicz was shot that evening in Lubyanka prison. So the Gulag Archipelago, Solzhenitsyn's most well-known work, was not the work to which he devoted more than 50 years of his life. Even from his university days, when he belonged to the Communist Youth Group, he aspired to write the history of the revolution. He was a great writer. He majored in mathematics and physics, but his avocation had always been writing. He was a great writer. But he wanted to write the history, the definitive history. So, but life changes our perspective, doesn't it? Things change. He was arrested in February 1945 at age 26, while serving as a decorated officer in the Red Army. Served 8 years in a corrupted labor camp. And it was during those years that he came to understand the evil of the system he had so naively supported. He experienced a conversion, returning to the Orthodox faith of his childhood. His eight-volume history of the revolution is titled The Red Wheel. Not all volumes have been translated into English, though the work continues, funded by an anonymous donor. And the University of Notre Dame Press has the publishing rights to all subsequent volumes as they come out, so you can watch for those. But anyway, the lie that is exposed in this volume opus, though, is different from the other one. It is this one, that the revolution was a historical inevitability. This is, of course, the Marxist view of history, as Dreher has noted in chapter 3 of his book. The Marxist view of historical inevitability has the convenient corollary that no one is responsible for what happened. These phases of development along the path to human and social betterment just move forward, always. Socialism goes back from the October Revolution to the February Revolution, then even back to August of 1914, to look at the choices, or lack of choice, made by people entrusted with the responsibility of ruling the state. We might say that governance was their vocation. It was their responsibility. There were other choices they could have made. However, once those opportunities were lost, the wheel began to roll. And as one author describes it, the red wheel began to turn with something like cosmic intensity. Its tails, its ultimate destination, was nothing less than the Gulag Archipelago. So Solzhenitsyn spent more than 50 years fighting these two lies, that the revolution was inevitable, and that the political system it ushered in would have been fine if it hadn't been for Stalin. So, although I may be anticipating the second part of Dreher's book, How to Live in Truth, I'd like to close with a few observations of what I learned from my reading of the dossiers of Russian Catholics arrested for their faith, lessons that have served me well these last 9 months, and I offer them to you. I think they will be part of your discussion of the second part of this book, but none of these suggestions requires a class or program or a course. They're all things you already know. So I'll just list them all. So, Christian, know who you are. Remember where you're going. Exercise the theological virtue of faith by recalling every day the promises of Christ. You know, we say at the end of the rosary that we may be worthy of the promises of Christ. What are those promises? Every day when you say that, remember one of them. I will be with you to the end of time. I go ahead of you to prepare a place for you. In my Father's house, there are many rooms. Pause. If you can't remember them, maybe go back to the gospel and try again so that you can have them on the tip of your tongue. Because when something like this happens, you know, like it happened to the Russians, that's all they had was what was in their hearts, in their minds, and on the tips of their tongues. So put them there, okay? So, and then exercise the theological virtue of hope. Look to the promise of heaven and know that it can be yours. The theological hope, as Aquinas talks about, has four qualities. So let me just run this. Okay, so it has to be for something good. It has to be something in the future. Obviously. It has to be difficult to obtain. It's going to be arduous. Okay? But you can attain it. It is within you, with God's grace. Theological hope is manifested through magnanimity. And it is protected by humility. So, be big soul. Rise to the greatness of your vocation. Don't hunker down. Be who you are as Christians. You know. Watch out for acedia. The dog is acedia as well. Despair, death, evagio mentis. That mind jumping around like a flea from one internet site to another. Curiosity, loquacity looking, the constant chatter, excessive curiosity. You know, Aquinas distinguishes between studios, studiousness, and curiosity. Curiosity is a bias, or maybe studious would be a virtue. Memorize your prayers. We all know some of them, but we could know more. Read the lives of the saints and be grateful. So, I've given you all prayer cards of Mother Catherine of Rukosova. She was the head of a Russian Dominican community in Moscow that was suppressed in 1924. Put the card in an unusual place, and then when you stumble upon it, by chance, remember that here is somebody who went without the sacraments for 8 years while she was in solitary confinement, and that she died in prison without the benefit of the last trance. In her cosmic canonization was open. It was begun in 2001. So that's all I have. That's what I wanted to offer you. It's hard for me to have. You know, there are so many, of course, there are underneath fundamental similarities, but just because of the passage of time, there's so many things that are totally different. The surveillance techniques under the Soviet period were very crude, but very effective. You know, having your room bugged, there are words that come up when you're doing translations that nobody knows in English, like denunciation. Do you know what that would be? A denunciation? Well, that would be when you'd go down to the county clerk's office and you say, you know what, my coworker just said something about Stalin that I think is very, very rude. Okay, that's fine. That takes care of your coworker. So, to be denounced. And so, well, the last priest that served at the parish in Vladivostok, that was how he ended up in prison camp. One of the parishioners denounced him. He said something during the homily that I thought was offensive. You know, so you know, when this all started, you know, I was very concerned. You know, about seeing Father Daniel locked up in a concentration camp. You know, because of things that you know somebody could say. So I became a little bit spooked. But now, of course, the surveillance techniques are much more smooth. You know, like you'll see in the next chapter, I don't want to be kind of spoiling this, but the whole idea of people having their smart speakers in their phones, yeah, it wouldn't take much, you know. All the things that you've ordered that are recorded, everybody knows what books you're taking out from the library. And of course, those are all protected. You're not supposed to be able to do that. But it takes, you know, a change of regime, a change of switch, and there it is. We all know what she reads, or who she talks to. Yes, Father.
I have a question. We briefly talked about this, but I don't know if you can expand or share some thoughts. In one of and not that all these things happen, but at times that leads us to more anxiety or just reading and reading and reading and talking and talking and talking. But what can we actually do about some of the challenges? So I myself find this very challenging, the balance between let's not give up, seeing the threats, the cultural, political threats, but at the same time, but what can we effectively do about these things? Where do we put our energy, our time?
The possibilities of resistance. Well, the title of this, the large historical novel, kind of shows it to us. Once a critical point in the past, and he places it during post-World War, some of the decisions that were made, some of the people that came into life, and then things will start once they started to roll. There was really no way to stop it. Now, some of the things that went on in the 20s, the Bolsheviks were careful not to execute people that would be high-profile people and well-recognized internationally, because they had not been recognized by the other governments, and they needed the recognition because they needed the cash. So, for example, in 1922, they loaded up a ship called the Philosopher's Ship, and they basically took all the high-ranking public figures from the church, from the academies, seminaries, and sent them to Berlin. And then they moved from there, some diffused through Paris, Switzerland, so that's how you have these large immigrant communities in Western Europe. That were you can't call them exiles, they were forced out of the country. Mother Catherine was actually married. She and her husband had converted and become Easternite Catholic, which allows married priests. But after after his ordination, they lived a Josephine marriage. But in 1922, when he was expelled with this large crowd, she decided to stay with the young women that had become part of the community. But before his expulsion, let's say from 1919, this would be during the Civil War, but in the large cities, there were chances for academic groups, theologians, and university professors to meet, to have discussions. One of the main discussions among the church people was having to do with the unification of the Orthodox and Catholic churches. And this was something that just drove the Bolsheviks mad. Can you imagine that kind of a unification, what that might have done? So that was not good. But for the rest, when I read the stories of the sisters that were all rounded up and served terms for, on and on, in prison, out of prison, in exile, sent all over, the formation that these young women must have had was incredible. And it could only have come from their homes. What they knew, what they had going into it, because there was no other way after that, to learn. You wouldn't hear homilies, you couldn't get, you couldn't have spiritual direction. What you had was what you had, and you needed to go as deep as you could with that. If you were a peasant from the Ukraine, and all you had was your rosary and your memory of the prayers, that is what you took. But just think of the richness that you could get from knowing the depths of the rosary and the prayers, and that sustained them. So, that's why I was saying, whatever you can, Yeah, that would be kind of an odd thing to say, wouldn't it, in the dorm?
Yeah.
So once you become shy about saying the things, about bringing the presence of Christ in your life, to verbalize that, then it starts to go away, and there's less of it. So I think where we are. So we need. So one of the things that we can do now, we can try to bring that back. Try to remember every day. You know, you're on the train, you're going downtown, but you're going someplace else too. Just bring that up so that you remember heaven every day. I know I'm up for years without thinking about it. What? You know, you're just caught up in your line, whatever. Father, I'm just rambling. I'm sorry. No, I'm just giving a microphone and it's gonna come out.
Are there any things that are obviously much more in our favor in our present situation? And, you know, the flip side of the question. So the things that are similar to be looked out for, but you know, maybe certain things that we certainly have as an advantage that we can, you know, take some solace in.
Yeah. I can't think of anything off. Good at this part of the presentation. Okay, one more chance.
I have a question for you. The Bolshevik movement, how large was that movement, and how long had it existed before it caught on? And compare that now to the progressive movement, which is basically the socialist and communist movement. So can you explain to me how big the Bolshevik movement was and how long it lasted as opposed to the progressive movement, which has been going on since the mid to late 20s and to now, which seems to be quite the theme to be a part of. And if you're not part of it, you should be part of it. And it's being taught in our schools. So can you tell me how much how big that movement was before it actually caught on and ran and everybody was afraid of it?
In Soviet Russia, you mean?
Yes.
Right, okay.
And I want to tie it into what's going on now with the progressive movement.
Yeah, okay then. Well, I guess you could start with the liberation of the serfs in 1860, right around the time of the emancipation here, and that, and then connect that with the Industrial Revolution and the movements of large numbers of people into the city. So you had all of the social unrest. And so in the 1880s, you started to have things like assassinations of people in the political arena, in the royal family. Things would be suppressed, things would be opened up. In 1905, there was a so-called revolution, but people argued about that because it didn't actually result in a change of regime. It loosened up a lot of the restrictions. Against, a number of things. But anyway, that kind of quieted things down for a little bit. But then, you know, World War I began in 1914, and it's all kinds of disruption. The Russian army was poorly prepared for any kind of engagement with the West. It was just a slaughter. The Bolsheviks took advantage of that. So in terms of, this is an interesting point, that the word Bolshoi in Russian means large. It means, so used as a noun here, we mean the majority. And then the word Mensch means the minority. But that was not actually true. The Bolsheviks are a very small number of hardcore, hardcore activists. And I can't give you any numbers, but they were not representative of, you know, the people from the revolution in February. Had much more of a, you know, kind of a liberal agenda. They wanted to get rid of the Tsar, but they also had ideas of, they would never have gone as far. But the fact that it looks like the people between February and October, the leadership was mindless. I mean, one person, another person, and then things got out of hand, and the Bolsheviks took advantage of it. And basically, that's what happened. Once they got control, that was it.
So you say it happened over probably about a 50 or 60 year period. It just slowly boiled, and they built upon their numbers, and they capitalized on the situation when World War I happened.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad I was able to answer it satisfactorily. Does anybody else have a question? Okay.
I don't know if there's a way to really compare. Is there any comparison, like, with this governmental situation, you know, Tsarist Russia is very much a top-down structure already, versus what we have in a more democratic society? I mean, however many facades we have to tear down to see what we have, but can you compare that, like, bringing that element to the comparison between them and now, just the government that we currently have versus what they had?
The government that we have compared to the government that they had?
Right, and how that might apply to mm-hmm. what followed for them. Like, they had a high minority in power, and the vast multitude of the society was being visibly oppressed by them, or that's how it was perceived.
Mm-hmm.
How does that compare to a democracy where we seem to have more of a 50-50 split, at least political party-wise, and how might that play into it?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of afraid to get into an area that is really not my competence. I know we've got some experts here in town that could help you out with, you know, I love talking with them, but it's probably not my question. Yeah, sorry.
No.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
This one you'll be able to answer, I know you will. What compelled you to go into studying Russian literature? I'm curious what inspired you to go into Russian literature studies?
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, you know, in high school I was a Latin major, and you know, when I was getting ready to go to college, I was 17 years old, and I just knew more than most people, of course. You know, I was sure that I knew that Russian was going to have a future and Latin wasn't. and so I'm from Indiana, and Indiana University just happened to be, I didn't know this, but happened to be the flagship university with respect to Russian studies. And so I got in, and there it was. You know, I wanted to teach language, and you know, I wasn't going to teach like French or something. Or Spanish. Yeah, so that's how I did it. And you know, Russian literature was just part of the program. It was the language that I was most fascinated by, and I enjoyed teaching it, but thank you. Yes?
What work are you currently engaged in?
What work am I currently engaged in, besides?
Well, just, I understand you're doing some. You translate, right?
Yes. A few years ago, I translated a collection of materials about the Dominican sisters that I've referred to, okay? And simultaneous with that, I was working on translating what would be called a book of remembrance. And this would be like a coffee table book, you know. It would have, you know, entries about the people that had been persecuted or repressed under the Soviet regime. So in 1991, when all of this fell apart, there was an urgent push to gather as much information as possible from the people that were still living. So all over the former Soviet Union, there were little, you know, the regions, what we would call states, provinces, counties, there were committees that put together what they would call a book of remembrance. And we had all of the people from their area that they, you know, they were able to get information about the grandparents, the father, whatever. So the Catholic Archdiocese, for the Jubilee year 2000, had, was putting together a collection of Catholic laity and clergy. And, you know, they got that all together. They had almost, just shy of 2,000 entries. And that is what I translated. And it came from this, the impetus for this was that after all of this stuff fell apart in 1991, there was immediate, well, over the next several years, books would come out that talked about the atrocities that had been discovered, and they had numbers that were just mind-boggling. And after you read a couple of these, it's like, how do you remember any of this? You know, there were 500 million peasants, or 500,000 peasants per year, or whatever. And then finally I found myself saying, well, just who were these people? What did you have to do to be arrested? And so I found a website that had these entries posted. I started after work and come home and just do two or three of them. And I'd share them with my friends and say, you know, look up this. I mean, here she was. She was 24 years old and she was arrested. And then how many times can you be arrested? Well, it just depends on how young you are when they start. She was arrested 4 times in her life, this Sister Philomena. And so I started to just do these. And when I was halfway through with them, it's like I'm sitting in the loft of my condo just doing these and thinking, well, where is this going? You know? So I got in touch with the history department at the University of Notre Dame. There was a professor there that came out of Stanford University. And that's the Stanford, the Hoover Institute is the gold standard for anything about the Soviet period. Anyway, the fact that he was from there, the fact that it was a Catholic university, thought, okay, I'm just going to email him, tell him what I'm doing. And then within, you know, the same evening, I got an email back and said, you know, we very much would like to do that with you. So they created a website, and you can go onto that website and put in, for example, you can put in Dominican and pull up all the Dominicans that suffered. You can put in S.J. and pull up the Jesuits or anything else. Or you can put up parish council. You see all the people that served on the parish council all over that are arrested. Oh, you can put in Saints of the Mall. Because, you know, they all got into all these people that were like running around doing charity works. Gotta stop that. You know. Especially since the Saints of the Mall have foreign connections. You know, it's based out of Paris. So that was what I was doing there, simultaneously with the book, because they were related, and a little time on this, and that. So finally those things were done. Then I was looking at translating a book about a doctor from Germany that had served in Moscow in the 19th century, and he has been beatified. But it didn't seem like it would be readable, you know. There was too much local detail about the history of prisons to make it something that would be of interest to you, you know. So really, I haven't done anything that. I'm tutoring a couple kids. Yes.
If they want to go beyond that, can you give us sort of a guide to approaching his other works and what you would recommend?
Yes, I would say after you've heard that, then you'll want to read the Gulag Archipelago. It's even like it's, okay, so it's three volumes, but you'll find that the way it's organized is that each chapter is about a particular issue. And they're not connected. It's not something that you have to follow the story all the way through all three volumes. You could pick up volume two and read chapter 22. You know, and it might be about the care of children, the happy life, the happy childhood of all children under the Stalinist regime. Wouldn't you like to know about that? And he just nails it, you know? And then, you know, then it might be about, well, what happened to the people that carried the letters? The letter carriers, so let's talk about them. You know, and then he'll go into that, because what he's got to work with are these 227 letters that have come to him, you know, from people all over the country, and they have told their story about, you know, what has happened to them, and so on and so forth. So he's working all of that detail into different pieces. So it's all, it's something that you can manage to read without feeling like this is like, oh my God, they have two volumes. The other, the 8-volume history, I've started it, and it's like, it's engrossing, just like Kanabasa. That in a way, demonstrations and so on were compulsory. You know, so, you know, there's, this is recorded in different places I've seen, you know, like a large, you know, large audience, people are clapping, and you don't want to be the first one to stop clapping, do you? No. So they keep on clapping. It was an equalization of the population, but mostly that happened by they moving the top. And so what was left was a little bit more homogenous. You could say they accomplished quite a bit in the area of literacy. Was it such a great thing to be able to read the kinds of stuff they were publishing? Socialist realism, that kind of literature. You know, lies, on top of lies, you don't have to read, you can read that. Anyway, so there's that. And then in the medical field, most of the medicine and the practice of women, when I was there in the mid-60s, if you were going to the hospital, you brought your own machines, and your family came with a food. You know, they didn't have these cafeterias. And then, what else was good? Well, you could buy a complete set of the works of Pushkin for very little money. And then the arts, the museums were open for very little money, very little prices. Some of these cultural things. Were made available to a lot of people. But I come back to the old saying that we had, you can't make a slip inside the sow's ear. What it was they could appreciate. But their music was beautiful, and just gorgeous. I don't know, we continue to, well, actually, come on. But the terror that they lived in, the terror, is what they lived in.
What is this
sound like? The point here and the one right there.
What's your assessment of the state of Christianity today in Russia?
In Russia? Oh. Well, you know, what I hear is that fewer than 1% attend church. You know, right after 91, there was a huge interest in church. You know, a lot of missionaries from all different denominations showed up. It was so galling to the Russians. I mean, you know, they accepted Christianity in 988. They had 1,000 years of Christian history. And so you had people coming over here from as though they knew nothing. Well, they were not newbies, if you will. But what I found out, and this is just some anecdotal way to say, but it was kind of like, we already tried that, and it didn't work. You know, so yeah. And you know, there is somebody on the board of Focus who is connected with the mission in the Far East, and I meant to try to see if I could find out who that was and maybe put him in touch with Father Daniel if you wanted to know. Somebody that, you know, is really in the know about the church in Russia. He would be good. Tyler Colden is his name. Is it Tyler? Yeah. Okay.
Do you know?
Okay.
Ruthlessness of like the Bolshevik
I'm sorry, could you just maybe once more, maybe a little louder?
The rude, just the brutality of what they were doing. Like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
What is that?
Okay, you know, one thing that they say is that from, let's see, was it about 1250 to 1550, they lived under the Tatar yoke. And the Central Asia that had overrun Russia. And they claim that that's where they learned all the brutality. But then you have Ivan the Terrible, who carried on that kind of brutality. And you know, just reading the accounts of this doctor I was talking about, the conditions in prisons, big piece of legislation in the 1830s was to require a doctor to be present at all floggings, just in case the person was about to die. You know? Yeah, so sad. But, you know, I say that now knowing what were the conditions of England and Italy and the United States and the prisons at that time.
So do you think it was more of like a Russian kind of cultural thing? Also, from like socialism?
Yeah. You know, that seems almost like maybe not such a. I don't want to be passing on, some of the cultural biases that I inherited from the people I studied with, but, you know, they kind of felt that. I mean, what I picked up was that the Russians had been subjected to a little brutality, and therefore it was. We can see a parallel with this. Don't we say that children that are raised in families, you know, with brutal situations that go on to brutalize their children? Yeah. And then, you know, vodka was such an important part of the whole scene. You know, the 19th century, the tax on liquor supported the government. But I thought you were going to ask about the personality of the people subsequent to the revolution, and that's an interesting thing to see how they became insensitive to other human beings. They became the moral detritus is pretty awful to see. And that one of the things I like about the Focus program is that it sends 10 college kids every year to take a look at this and see what happens, because it's pretty ugly. My son had a major in history from Boulder, and then when he graduated, he said, "Mom, I have a chance to teach English in the Czech Republic." And I said, "Oh, that's wonderful. Go." You know, it fairly much inoculated him as he saw the dishonesty and the moral turpitude, the lackadaisical attitude of people toward everything, the cheating in the academic world. You know, I mean, what happens when you get scientific research done and people cheat? Doesn't work. Yeah. So, you know, they're not going to have time to discuss unless they stay online.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.